Just before we came onto this pulpit this morning, one of the readers of the morning asked me, I thought a bit hopefully, whether I was going to suggest titles this morning that we ought not read. This is not my purpose. I want to speak of the value of books and of valuable books. And this discussion of books and of their place in our personal lives was suggested by a visit I made last week to our Cleveland Museum of Art. I hope that many of you have seen the collection from the library of Mr. J.P. Morgan, which is being featured there this month. It's a magnificent collection. There you see some of the most magnificently illustrated manuscripts ever created by man. There is an old 12th century Christian Psalter done by a pious monk in Monte Cassino. How many generations of his brothers used this Psalter to lead their worship? And as you look at the beautiful illustrations on each page, you are impressed by the piety and the reverence and also the artistic skill of the man who undoubtedly spent years of his life in creating this master book. And side by side with this Psalter is a besilvered, bejeweled Quran, the holy book of Islam, a triumph of the art, the piety, and of the skill of some Arab scribe. Further on in the room is the first Hebrew Bible ever printed, as clear, as precise, as legible today as it was 5 centuries ago when it was first struck. As you walk further along, you come to holographs, original manuscripts by the modern geniuses of our literature, by Browning and by Poe and by Wordsworth. You see their penmanship. You see their corrections and their erasures, their precision with the use of words. And you feel closer than you have ever been to the personalities of these great men. It's an awesome experience. It's a reverential experience to enter this display room. It is as if you are entering one of the throne rooms in which the genius of the human spirit presides. For these are valuable books, and they impress you with the value that men have set by their books. Here you see the manuscripts, the painfully, laboriously handwritten copies of the great books of antiquity. The only link that we have with the classic Psalms and prophecies of the Hebrews, with the classic philosophy of the Greeks and the classic poetry of Rome. If each generation had not taken upon themselves the task of sitting down and copying word by word, sentence by sentence, at whatever cost of time, these classics, we would not be able to read from them today. Think what role these books must have had in their civilization, how precious and how rare they were. We are spoiled by the plentifulness of books. We are spoiled by the fact that our home libraries probably contain more volumes than did any of the finest libraries of Europe during the Middle Ages. A volume then might cost 100, 200, 500 times what a printed work costs for us. When we went to the universities, we were told what texts we should buy, and we went to the university bookstore. We bought them. In olden times, the university session was begun by a paid lecturer standing in front of the class and reading to them from the text which was to be the subject of this semester's work. And the class each had to sit down and to make its own copy for study. So valuable were books that often if a man left even one or two volumes to a university or to a monastery library, it was considered as if he had left that institution a princely legacy. For books were rare, rarer than we might imagine. So rare, in fact, that I think that if all the volumes and folios and manuscripts available in medieval Europe in the 12th or the 13th centuries had been added up and brought into one building, they would not equal the 10,000 volumes which repose today in our temple library. Books were not available to all. If you wanted to read, you had to go to the university or monastery library, and there you would find the book chained to your reading desk. If a certain volume was not available in your community, you either had to do without, or you had to hire a scribe in some distant city to copy it for you. It was a pious duty incumbent upon every Jew to either copy out the Bible in his lifetime, or else to have some scribe copy it for him. So rare was that book which we freely hand out this day. Think what a difference this made in the life of the everyday man. Books were not available to him. The wealth of tradition, of knowledge, of philosophy and of art and of thought, of poetry and of play, which we take for granted, was almost shut to him. He either had to be told it, or rarely he had the opportunity to go to some institution to read it. There was an intellectual lag in the cities of the ancient world which beggars description. I remember coming across once a medieval Spanish manuscript. It was the manuscript of a book on physics by the second century Greek Galen. And in the margin of this manuscript, some 13th century Spanish scholar had noted, "Would that I had read this book 7 years ago. I have been working for 7 years on a proof which Galen discovered 1400 years before I began to live." It's inconceivable to us that scholars today might even lack information of what the laboratories of yesterday have discovered and uncovered. But 1400 years often passed before knowledge passed from one part of the world to another. Our Torah stands as an ever-present reminder of those ancient days. It is still written by hand. It is written on parchment, copied word for word, painfully and laboriously. It takes months and sometimes years to complete. And when it is completed, its value is several hundred times that of the printed Bibles which we might buy in any bookstore. And yet, because our people copied this Bible in each generation, as they copy the classics of antiquity, they are available now to us. And we maintain this old way, this archaic way of writing our Bible in reverence and thankfulness for the piety and the faithfulness of these copyists and calligraphers and scribes of old. The invention of printing is said to have taken place in China. We do not know the exact year, but by the 13th century, the Chinese had both a movable type press and a simple linotype machine. The invention of printing in the West is associated with Holland and with Germany and with the 15th century. And a copy of the first book ever printed, a Bible printed by John Gutenberg in 1450, is available in this display this month at our Museum of Art. What a radical change printing made in our ways of life. I personally believe that, except for the development of the wheel and of the compass, there has been no invention ever made by man which was both beneficial and as beneficent. This intellectual lag, this time lag in the transference of knowledge from one man to another was almost done away with. What we are doing in our laboratories today will be by tomorrow or by next week known throughout the world. Not only have the scholars benefited from the invention of printing, but the time it takes for the news of new discoveries, of new knowledge about the world which surrounds us to percolate down to us has been radically diminished. It took the world almost 1400 to 1500 years to even begin to understand and assimilate the meaning of Aristotle's view of life. It took the world over 300 years to understand the implications of Galileo's discoveries. It took the world 50 years even to become aware of the nature of the theories which Darwin was expounding. But within a decade, within 10 brief years, most cultured men, most educated men had grasped the essential facts of Einstein's much more complicated discoveries. We have reduced significantly the time it takes for men's minds to cross-pollinate so that each of us is much more keenly aware of the new discoveries of our world than was ever the case in previous history. We have made it possible for the progress of the human race to proceed at an unprecedented pace. And scholars tell us that we have every reason to believe that the progress of the human race in matters scientific, in matters technological, will grow more in the next 10 years than it did in all of past recorded history. And one of the reasons for this is the development of printing, the dissemination of information, exchange of ideas between men who are able to use and to grasp these new ideas and put them to better use for our own benefit. Not only was the exchange of ideas made possible between almost all men, but I believe that the development of printing made it possible for the age of the common man, for the age of the great democracies of our world to come about. You know, in medieval and ancient times, knowledge was a carefully guarded secret. Knowledge is power. And the guilds and the various professions, the various priest groups, carefully kept secret and guarded their knowledge about their professions and about their trades. It was not available for all, so that any who had particular talents or ambitions in this line might avail himself of this particular occupation. But with the development of printing, all this was swept aside. Any man who wanted to read of the techniques of the philosophers, of the art of the physician, of the role of the priest and of theology, of the art even of the tool maker and the clothier, could come and could read. And if he was able, and if he had talent, he could set his hands and his mind to this particular occupation. And so the able of the so-called lower classes began to compete successfully, economically, with these privileged orders. And as they rose in the social scale, they demanded that all the political barriers which were interposed between the nobility, between the merchant guilds and themselves, be done away with. And we got the revolutions which made it possible for our modern type of social democracies to come into being. Knowledge is power. And some of the great heroes of the modern world have been those who made it possible for the printed book to be transmitted to all men, even when the vested authorities were against it. Think what it meant to the men of the New Age who could now have their views broadcast broadly. When the rebels of ancient times felt the injustice of some decree, they could speak directly to as many hearers as they could gather in the forum or in some hall. Or if they could gather enough disciples, they could put these disciples to work busily, hand by hand, writing out manuscripts and letters telling of their grievances. But how many letters can the human hand write? Often, these few letters would be impounded by the police. Often, the police would raid the hall in which the man was trying to speak. But now, with the movable type printing press, hundreds upon thousands of copies of pamphlets of dissent could be printed. What Thomas Paine said on a Sunday could, by the Friday of the next week, be read in every village and hamlet of the 13 colonies. What Monsieur de Voltaire wrote about the social order and his hatred for it could be bought by almost any Frenchman for a sou or less, and could be taken to his home and to be read there in the privacy of his room. What Martin Luther preached was heard thousands of miles away, and not only by the few who had the privilege of coming into his church and hearing his views. The pace of social change was rapidly increased because it was possible for men to read the literature of dissent, because this literature could now be sent out broadly. And as they read, they began to think. And as they thought, they began to themselves to become dissatisfied and to see what plans could be made for righting the wrong. They began to see how they could band together in the confraternity of those seeking a better ordering of society. And once they learned the secret of banding together, of using their power, the world had come a long way towards the creation of of a more equal society. And as the development of printing made it possible for the political barriers to an equal society to be cast down, so it made it possible for the priestly and clerical barriers to a free society to be done away with. Almost all religions have seen certain special groups, usually priest groups, claim that they knew some special knowledge, that they had some esoteric insight into the will of God. Usually they said that this knowledge was given to them by the sacred scripture, which the founder of the faith had put into their hands. That unless the people allowed them to relay their prayers to God, relay them with a gift of money or a bribe, and unless they translated the will of God back to the people, God would not hear their prayers, and they would not hear God's answers. And so almost always in antiquity and in the Middle Ages, these priest groups tried to keep the sacred scriptures, the Bibles of the world, secret, their own particular province, and not open to all men. Now, our own Jewish faith was the first faith which succeeded in breaking open the Bible that it might be read for all people. We have always been a faith, as we discussed last week. We have always been a faith which emphasized education. And because we did so, and because we created a group of interested laymen, rabbis, scholars, teachers, who felt the inequality and the inequity of the claims of the priest group, about the first century of the Common Era, about 2,000 years ago, a great revolution took place in Jewish life. The priests had of old controlled all sacrifice in the temple. The priests were in control of all the ritual and rites which had to do with our Jewish life. But the Pharisees, the rabbis, broke this monopoly. They claimed that the Bible was not the sacred province of this priest group. It was an open territory, an open book, open for the perusal and the study of all men. That there was no esoteric knowledge in the Bible which could not be understood by whoever had the ability to so understand. And they said that the religious vocation should be one of choice, not of blood and of heredity. The very fact that we read the Bible publicly in our synagogues, that we have developed in our synagogues the custom of reading the Bible consecutively, so that from the beginning of one year to its completion, the man who will be regular in his attendance will have heard the whole Bible read, was taken to be a living testimony to the fact that the Bible was an open book, capable of being heard, or read, or studied, or understood by anyone who desired to spend the time. And as the Torah was taken out of its ark, the rabbis in the synagogue said that these words should be said as a perpetual reminder to the Jewish people that the Bible is an open group, and that we need no priests, no people armed with some special lore to interpret it for us. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha kihilas Yaakov. This is the Torah which God commanded us through Moses. It is the inheritance of the whole congregation of Israel, not of the priests, not of the Kohanim, not of the Levites, but of all of Israel. Now in Christianity, lay people had to await the availability of the Bible before they too were able successfully to rebel against the tyranny of a priest group. Gutenberg's first edition, the first book ever printed, was a Bible. What a revolution this Bible brought about. For as copies of the Bible were distributed, as the price was reduced so that people could buy it and bring it into their homes and read it in the quiet of an evening, they began to realize the vast difference between the teachings of the Bible, of the New Testament and of the Old, and the actions of the church about them. Jesus, they found, had preached a doctrine of apostolic poverty, that the apostles, the religious, ought to be otherworldly men, men who do not reap either wealth or power by their worldly vocation as priests. And yet as they looked about themselves, they saw that the church was both worldly and wealthy. Jesus, they found, had been a pacifist, And he felt that the church and the religious man ought to keep a hands-off policy as regards the political disputes and the petty bickerings between nation and nation and government and government. But as they looked about themselves, they found that their church had a hand in every political quarrel throughout Europe and even sponsored and maintained a professional army. As they read through the New Testament, they found that there is no mention there made of a pope or of the supremacy of Rome. So they began to ask their priests and their leaders how they could justify their demands that they submit themselves to all the theological doctrines which Rome had since the days of the New Testament devised. As they read the Bible, they began to question the religious order which surrounded them. By reading the Bible, they became Protestants. They rose in protest, and a new religion, a much more democratic way of worshiping God, was devised. Parenthetically, I should add this. The Muslim world, the world of Islam, is the only world which has not yet had either a religious or a political revolution. It is the only world which is still steeped in medieval ways, where there are priest classes and privileged classes. And it is strange to note that no Mohammedan country has ever permitted the printing of the Quran. That literacy is not a major concern of Arab governments. That less than 1 in 10 in most Arab countries, and some less than 1 in 1,000, are capable of reading. Not having read, they have not been disturbed from the ancient ways. They have not been able to see the inequalities of their position. But books ultimately cannot be always kept away from people. They will learn to read. And when they do, a mighty revolution will shake, I believe, that part of the world. These are the blessings, then, the rich blessings which books have given men. But there are no blessings without its duties and without dangers. We are blessed with books. Our democracy and our way of life is made possible by books. And if this is so, we must see to it that we are never censored or prevented from reading the books which might be of benefit to us. The dictatorships of the world have always devised ways of regimenting man's reading, of restricting his reading, of saying to him, this thou shalt read, and this is dangerous, or this is subversive, this thou shalt not touch. That if they develop either indexes, lists of books which are beyond the pale, which it is a sin to open and to read, or they try to license the publishers so that they will print only books which are harmless, books which cannot disturb man's views, or they try to engage in book burning, in eradicating the great literature of the past, the literature which expresses the ideals and the hopes of common humanity, the literature such as the Bible, which has always inspired men to seek for a better life. The dictators are quite right in attempting to censor books, to license publishing, and to burn books, because ideas are their greatest enemy. And only if they succeed in imposing a conformity of ideas can they have any hope of long maintaining their power. And we in our country have in the past few years seen that the demagogues and those who would dictate our ideas made their first attack against the freedom of libraries. They began by saying, let us see that the libraries overseas have only books which conform with the American way of life. And if the McCarthyites had been successful there, they would have leveled an attack against the public libraries in America, as they did in certain Midwestern states, and have said that there should be nothing on these shelves which might harm the young mind, which might disturb the mind, which might make him feel less American, less patriotic. And if they had succeeded in dictating our reading, they would have dictated our thoughts and ultimately our vote, ultimately our way of life. The price of being able to read, the price of having a great variety of books, is eternal vigilance against those who would censor our reading and reduce the number of books. available to us. But reading today presents another type of problem, and this is what I would concern myself with today, where we are, as it were, deluged by an avalanche of books. Think of this. Last year, 12,581 new titles, new books, were published in America alone. If we had the capacity to read a book a day, it would take us 40 years just to read the new books that came out in the last 12 months. I remember as a freshman at college entering Harvard's Widener Library for the first time. There are 12 floors of books in that library. Each floor has over an acre of stacked space. There are over 4.5 million volumes in that one building, each different, each a different title and work. And I remember being absolutely transfixed. Where could I begin? What could I ever hope to accomplish against this vast mass of information, of books, of literature, which the world placed before me? We are almost deluged by this avalanche of books, buried underneath it, incapable of seeing how we can even begin to sort out from ourselves the worthwhile from the worthless and find some way of reading at least that which will be of benefit and of enjoyment to us. We are plagued almost with too many books. We have learned the truth of the biblical statement of the making of books, there is no end. We almost wish that many of these titles might remain manuscripts locked away safely, never to see the light of day. Now, what has been our answer to this avalanche of books? Some of us have become concerned with increasing our reading speed. I know of schools where the young scholars are graded on how many pages they can read in the course of an hour. I know of many of adults who have enrolled in special classes designed to teach them the art of speed reading. And because of this emphasis on speed, I think we are in danger of becoming a generation of hot rod readers. The hot rod driver keeps his eyes dead center on the road. He's concerned only with the speed with which he can go from his point of origin to his destination. He knows nothing of the beauty of the countryside through which he is passing. The flowers along the wayside are just a blur to him. The brook coursing underneath the bridge that he is crossing is just a disturbance as far as his driving is concerned. If we are concerned only with the speed of reading, if we have become hot rod readers, then all of the landscape with which a book abounds, the magnificence of detail, the beauty of style and of idiom, the clarity and the incisiveness of description escapes us. All we try and do is to read the opening sentence and see how quickly we can get to the concluding one, and hope that at least along the way we have learnt enough of the names of the characters in the storyline to be able to discuss it at the next cocktail party that we attend. James Russell Lowell once described such a reader as a reading machine, always wound up and going. He has mastered all the knowledge that's not worth the knowing. Our Bible, or rather our tradition, calls them chamor nosei sfarim, donkeys laden with books, literary jackasses, people who have read hundreds upon hundreds of volumes to know what has been said, but who haven't an iota of understanding of how it was said, who have little feeling for the style, for the nuances, for the shadings, for the descriptions, for all that goes into to separate the artless in literature from the art of literature, the great book and the good book from the worthless book and the meaningless book. This hot rod reading spoils great literature for us. You could not pick up a Thomas Mann or a Franz Kafka or a Tolstoy and attempt to read it by simply glancing down whatever words happen to be in the center of the page. You would have no understanding whatsoever of the rich symbolism with which these books abound, the shadings of character which they so beautifully portray for us. You would have forgotten that it is not so much what is said, but that it is how it is said, which makes for the good book, for good literature. And similarly, perhaps more importantly, most books, certain types, cannot be read by hot rod reading. You cannot read philosophy. You cannot read your professional journals where you must be concerned with every detail. You cannot read science. You cannot read poetry by hot rod reading. This is a type of literature which must be chewed as a cow chews its cud, over and over and over again, to be understood and to be appreciated. Several months ago, a college freshman came back to the temple and proudly announced to me that he had managed to read through Plato's Republic in 2 hours. And I could not help but remember the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Chicago, who at the beginning of a course on Plato several years ago told us, "You know, I read and reread the Republic for 10 years before I began to really understand what it is all about." There is certain literature which must be read deliberately and slowly, paragraph by paragraph, and line by line. Only then will the fullness of a thought emerge to you. Somebody once advocated that we read great literature as we would read the love letters which we once received from our sweetheart. Over and over and over again. You remember those letters. Each time we read them, we found a new meaning. We read behind the lines, that we understood the nuances, the subtleties, what was said and what was not said. And great literature must be read in this way. It must be read over and over and over again in order to understand exactly what it was that the author intended to convey. I had occasion the last few weeks to have this point dramatically driven home to me. In our pre-confirmation class in the temple this year, we have inaugurated a program of Bible reading. Our hope is that by exposing the young people to many of the narrative portions of the Bible, we will develop within them a love of Bible language and of Bible literature. We'll make them feel at home in the Bible, and that later on in their lives they will not be afraid to pick it up and read from it. We've read together the books of Jonah, Ruth, Esther, many of the beautiful narrative portions of Genesis. Now, I teach 3 of these classes each week. In each one of these classes, we go over the same paragraphs. We read them aloud together. You might think that I would become utterly bored by this constant repetition. Yet each time that a class deals with a text, I find new meaning in that text. I feel closer to it. I understand it the better. And I leave each class with a greater love for the book and a greater appreciation of the genius of the man who first wrote it. You in your own lives might try a simple experiment. Take a play of Shakespeare's. Take some beautiful poem of Browning's or any other piece of literature which you particularly love and resolve to read it once a week for the next month, 4 or 5 times in the course of several months. I think that you will come at the end of that period to really appreciate this work of art. You will love it the more, you will feel closer to it, and you will have understood it the more completely. The more you turn over a great book, the more you will find in it. And that is why it is not so much how much you have read, how many books you have completed, but how well you have read, and how much you have derived from the books which you have digested. But how shall we begin? What books shall we select? There is, of course, no worse guide to our reading than the bestseller list. Books appear on the bestseller list because they are faddish or sensational, because they have appealed to the erotic or the pathological instincts of our age. Today's bestsellers is inevitably clogged next year's secondhand bookshelves. Much that is worthwhile in our literature never makes the bestseller list. We should read whatever we want to read, whatever intrigues us, whatever interests us, whatever books we think we will enjoy, whatever books we will think we will learn something from or gain some benefit from. But as we read, we should remember one thing, that you can open a book and you can also close it. Many of us are compulsive about finishing any book that we begin. But most books, if you open their first few pages, either tell you, I am written well, there's a style here, I have something to say, or I simply wrote this to produce a book, to be paid the author's royalties, to be sensational. We ought to learn to close and put down the worthless books, the meaningless books. I'm sure that we won't be ostracized from society if we put down even the books which are most commonly discussed at our afternoon canasta games and evening parties. Learn to put down the books which do not appeal to you, because you will have to be your own critic. You cannot choose the books which appeal to any other person. His background is different, his training is different, his interests are different. You have to be your own critic. And books are a type of knowledge which you can learn about only by opening the book and by beginning to read from it. But the privilege of opening the book is also the privilege of closing it and putting it away. But if as you read a book you enjoy it, keep the book. Put it on your shelves. Learn to make the books which you have read and learned something from and enjoyed constant companions. You'll enjoy browsing in them again from time to time, refreshing yourself with their beauty. And perhaps even more important, your children, as they grow up, will be able to go to shelves filled with books which you have enjoyed and derive in some enjoyment from it. I often think that we forget how much the young people in our homes are culturally conditioned to the good things in the culture which surrounds us. We know that they are culturally conditioned by the television, by the movies, by the comic books, but they are also conditioned by the music which is played on the home Victrola, and by the books which are in the home bookshelves, and by the pictures which are on the walls of your home. The level of art, of culture, which you keep in your home will be the level which they will try to attain. And if these young people go to their parents' bookshelves and find their condensations of modern novels and the pathologically neurotic novels, sensational novels with which our day abounds, and perhaps one or two other cartoon books, this will be the level at which they will gear their reading. But if they go there and find more worthwhile things, books which open their eyes to new areas of life, to new geographies of learning, they will read these books and learn to love them. And all their lives, they will pick up books of that type and read them over. And I think also we ought to begin to redo in our homes a lost art. Most of us read to our children. That is, we read to them as long as they cannot read. We read to them the wonderful picture books which they so delight to have told to them. But the minute the schools have taught them the alphabet, we stop reading. We never again recapture those wonderful moments of togetherness when we and our child in a book are somehow banded together in love. And yet the fact that the child has learned to read does not mean that the child has developed a taste for the good in reading, or the child is aware of what beauty in style and beauty in language really means. If we would take poems or stories which appeal to the child, but which are yet good literature, well-written literature, and would read them aloud, the child's ear would learn to appreciate beauties of style and of language. And all his life, he will return to these books read with his parents with love. And he will look for books which have the same ring to them, the same sound to them, the same flavor to them as those which he read with his father. It is a vast sea, this world of books. There is no key to it, no critical avenue of approach save the one that we ourselves can develop. We must begin by reading. By reading whatever intrigues us. By learning to discriminate between the books which appear to us artless and those which appear to be good literature. And as we read, we will learn to discriminate. We will learn that we do not need to follow slavishly any man's 100 best books, be them what they may. But we will learn also, I think, one fact about the books of our day. Our age is unique in that it has produced a generation of popularizers, of men and of women who have seen to it that the previously scholarly levels of our universities are open to us, that physics and astronomy and mathematics and history and archaeology and all areas of research are made available to us in books which we ourselves can understand. Ours is the great age of scientific popularization, and these men have rendered us a great service in that they have made available to us some avenue of insight and of understanding into this radically new and ever-changing world which surrounds us. And we would do well to acquaint ourselves with many of these books, and to learn much more than we perhaps know of what our science tells us is the nature of our world, what our psychology tells us is the nature of our being, and what our sociology tells us is the nature of our relationships with other people. And similarly, as a rabbi, I would suggest to you that you begin to pick up the great popularizations of Jewish learning which have been written in the last decade. A good one has been written by one of the members of this congregation. Books about Jewish history, Jewish tradition, and Jewish learning. There are an amazing variety of these available if you would only, after services, go back into our library and ask Miss Lycan to tell you about books in whatever field might interest you. You know, we Jews are uniquely in need of books. This is a society in which Christianity is, to a sense, taught just by the living. Their holidays are public holidays. Their scriptures are often serialized in the public press or retold in dramatic form on the mass media of communication. But our tradition, our unique way of life, the reasons for our uniqueness and for our distinctiveness are not public knowledge. You can satisfy yourselves about their reason. You can learn more about the purpose of the continuing differences which we maintain religiously between ourselves and our neighbors only by going to Jewish books, by spending a few hours of your life arguing with them, learning from them, digesting what they have to say. These popularizations are of great value. Chas v'chalila, I would be ashamed to suggest that you read the great classics of our age, be they Jewish or non-Jewish. We're not a generation of classic readers. We ought to. They are the books which men have always claimed to be the acme of good literature. But we seem to be an age which prefers a popularization, but at least let us read these. Let us learn in digest form what these people have to say. Read widely. Read wisely. And I'm sure that you will enjoy the reading. You will feel more alive to the world about you. You will be more aware of the many beauties that it contains. You will be a fuller and completer person for having taken upon yourself the opportunity and the obligation of reading good books. Amen.